You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Slate's Audio Book Club. I'm Megan O'Rourke, a culture critic for Slate, and joining me today are Michael Agger, a Slate editor. Welcome, Michael.
Welcome. Hi.
And Troy Patterson, Slate's TV critic. Welcome, Troy.
Hey, Megan.
So today we are discussing the quote-unquote dark horse winner of the National Book Award, Lord of Misrule, a novel by Jamie Gordon. And we're joking here about this quote-unquote dark horse winner because the book is, it's about horses. It's about race horses, among other things. It's set at a seedy racetrack, Indian Mound Downs, which is downriver from Wheeling, West Virginia. And there are a lot of things we can say about this book. One of the things I think we could say right away is that it's very much a book that's portraying a microcosm. It's a deep look at a small world. And it raises a lot of interesting questions about style and plot and other things. We probably, you know, we were just talking about the fact that we probably wouldn't have been doing this book had it not won the National Book Award because it didn't sell very many copies. It was published by a small press and it had escaped our notice thus far before the award. But there's a lot we should say.
I think it escaped everyone's notice.
It escaped everyone's notice, not just ours.
I think except for trade publications, it didn't get reviewed anywhere until after it was nominated for the award.
Yes.
At which point it received a favorable notice from Jane Smiley in the Washington Post and a good write-up in the Daily Racing Form.
Oh, I'm surprised I missed that since I do like to check the Daily Racing Form out. But it also received a big piece in the New York Times by Janet Maslin, I think, who sort of made allusion to the fact that she had not seen this book or read this book. So it's probably one of the most long-shot winners of the National Book Award that's ever been. You were saying
that,
Michael.
A 25 to 1.
A 25 to 1. Maybe even a 50 to 1. 50 to 1. We should have been betting. So let's just start by saying, what did you guys... I mean, this is... I think our listeners are probably curious. You know, first of all, should they read this book? Second of all, what is it like? What is this book like? What did you guys... Did you guys enjoy it? What could we say about it?
I began by disliking it. I came around to it some. There are a lot of vivid images worth hanging on to. There are a lot of vivid images that are unfortunately memorable in their in their what's the color beyond purple?
Vermilion, perhaps.
And it's got sort of a pulpiness that I think works pretty well for the first maybe 75% of the book. I think the end is a little bit florid for my taste.
A little bloody, perhaps.
Yeah.
A lot of blood.
I mean, you definitely like turn the first page, and it's very much like, you know, capital L literary, you know, throwing into, you know, into a microcosm, this sort of horse racing subculture, as you point out, but also a kind of, you know, a very sort of almost interior hermetic writing. You know, it's like this. We're not going to explain this world to you. I'm going to use like strange, cold mountain-esque nouns that, you know, antiquated that you might not have heard of. And so it's definitely a trip down a back road of sorts right away. But I have to say, like you, Troy, the book did sort of sneak up on me and kind of won me over at the end. What were your impressions, Megan? Your general thoughts?
I mean, I love your description of it as a trip down a back road. Let's see. For me, it had a kind of what might look like a bell curve. I started off not liking the book all that much and feeling that it was an example of a kind of literary, very historically contemporary literary obsession with sentence writing and the image that we see in the novel. And we'll get to this later, but Chad Harbach talks about this a little bit, I think, in a recent piece he wrote in Slate and N+1 called MFA versus NYC. But there's a lot of similes right at the very beginning, right? And it's a kind of writing that draws attention to itself on the sentence level.
Can I start by digging into the first paragraph here?
Yeah, can I just say, finish my thought and then I want you to? But so I thought, okay, this is that kind of book, and I totally get why you said hermetic, Michael, because it feels right. But then, actually, what's so strange about this book, or what struck me as interesting about the book, is that it actually is it's almost like a noir novel or a kind of like Ross McDonald, but like there's this weird collision of, there's an intense plot going on in this kind of, you know, two-bit mafioso world happening, people, all sorts of sketchy things happening. And also it has this deeply erotic component, which I think we have to talk about, that then gets abandoned somewhat partway through the book, I thought. And so it kind of crescendoed for me, and then the very end fell off. That's my overall summary of the book. But,
all right.
But Troy, dig in.
Let's get, let's read the first four or five sentences here. Inside the back gate of Indian Mound Downs, a hot walking machine creaked round and round. In the judgment of Medicine Ed, walking a horse himself on the shed row of Barn Z, the going-nowhere contraption must be the lost soul of this cheap racetrack where he'd been ended up at. It was stuck there in the gate, so you couldn't get out. It filled up the whole road between a hill of horse manure against the backside fence, stubbled with pale, dirty straw like a penitentiary haircut, and a long red puddle in the red dirt, a puddle that was almost a pond. I like that puddle quite a bit, and I like the sort of the sense of place and the sort of atmosphere of the novel. There's a lot of red and a lot of dust and a lot of red dust. So it's got that going for it. I think initially I had to reread that first sentence three times to make sure I was reading what I thought I was reading, with a sort of pile up of assonance there. Inside the back gate of Indian Mount Downs, a hot walking machine creaked round and round. Sort of there's a kind of really unfortunate sort of sing-songiness to it.
Chiminess, yeah.
Although I do like the hot walking machine in the middle of it. But you're the person here who knows about horses. Can you describe what a hot walking machine is?
You know, I just hit something. I do know about horses, but I don't know that I've actually seen... I don't know that much about horses, as this book brought home to me. But I'm not so sure I've seen a hot walking machine. I was imagining... I mean, I think I have. I think that it's like there's a machine with these arms sticking out, and the horse's leads or shanks are attached to it, and they're kind of being pulled around like a merry-go-round almost, so very slowly. But I don't know so much.
And the point of it is that they're kind of – the horse is so sort of worked up after
they're
a race.
They're so worked up. Exactly. They can get colic and other things if they don't get cooled down. Their bodies they'll drink too much water, or they need to cool down. Even – you know how humans do after they exert themselves, but really briefly. But horses need to do it for a longer time. But, you know, I think right in that first sentence we see both the strengths and the flaws of this book, or what I took to be the strengths and flaws of this book. You know, Gordon really does have a wonderful sense of language, and there were so many bits of this that I really enjoyed. It also can get a little cute, a little overworked, you know, a little like a horse that's been ridden too hard, you know, like a little overdriven to the wire. Sometimes you feel the application of the whip, it felt to me.
Yeah. But, I think part of the problem with that in this first chapter, this is a book with multiple narrators, each with a distinct voice. And so in this first section here, we're listening to Medicine Ed, who's about 70 years old. He's sort of the wise old groom at the racetrack. And so he speaks, he's not quite literate, Medicine Ed is, and he sort of speaks in this amalgam of kind of like down-home figures of speech and is a sort of ungrammatical turns of phrase, which sometimes has some color in it. I also don't think that this is a case in which the are we going to call this a, it's something like a free indirect style. At any rate,
Well, yeah, it is. I think we can call it free and direct in the most. It's third person, but it's close third person, right? Like we can. We're in their minds usually. We're in their consciousness usually.
Yeah.
Except there is one character who's in the second person, which we should talk about.
Indeed. In any event, a problem that I have with Ed is that at some points he's kind of speaking in dialect, and then there are these kind of literary phrases or even like references that kind of work their way awfully close to his mouth in a way that's sort of jarring, and sort of the artifice of it set me on edge a bit. This is not to and this is perhaps tied together with the fact that Medicine Ed is just a little bit uncomfortable as a character. I think this sort of old woolly-headed Negro sort of working his magic with the horses.
And actually kind of literally, like he has all these powders.
Yeah, that is not a metaphor. Yeah.
It's not a metaphor. He's actually working his magic.
They had a bad Faulkner vibe to it or, you know, just, yeah. Like what you said, like not really a fully realized consciousness. Like you feel the kind of hand of Gordon there, you know, in that character in particular. But, you know, as we're talking about the kind of flowery edge, you know, the writing is moving along. You know, I will say the way the book is structured, you know, just, you know, by horse and typically, you know, is this horse that we're kind of introduced to, you know, going to win the race. I mean, that kind of basic element was enough to kind of power me through a lot of the kind of, you know, the sort of some of the thick syrup that you encounter along the way.
Right.
And so I was curious, you know, what you guys made of the kind of the horses themselves as characters, and you know, because that's.
I love that part. Yeah. I mean, I did think she did the horses really well. I mean, I bridled a little bit. Sorry.
I think we have to declare you know. I think we're at five. Or
okay, something. And they're all mine too. I think. I'm sorry. I don't know what's come over me. I objected slightly on page 26. We have, you know, we're sort of getting to know the novel and the characters, and we're in, I think, the second chapter, which introduces Maggie, who's the young woman who's in some ways at the heart of the book, and who I thought was a very interesting character. And actually, I wish that there had been slightly more about her, because I really enjoyed the parts with her. But she's got this, I think we're meant to believe she comes from a slightly upper class, upper middle class family. I couldn't really tell. At first, it seemed like that, but then her uncle is this guy.
Well, she's sort of. We know that she's a college
she's educated.
Dropout.
So right.
She's not
hippie.
Really in her right. milieu at this
right.
sort of.
At this track.
Low down, dirty
right.
racetrack.
And we know that she's a hippie. We also know, by the way, it's 1970, which is interesting. That is not a book, right? Set in the contemporary
yep.
time. So she's a hippie. And she's kind of hanging with the horses. And you have the sense of a bit that she doesn't know, you know, compared to, for example, Medicine Ed, who's fully at home in this world, that she's learning her way around the world. And she's walking a horse around who's, and he, you know, we have this description of he curveted like a colt, squealed, and cow kicked alarmingly near her groin. Okay, she said, and handed it over. She was glad there was no man around just then to tell her to show that horse who was boss. When they were back in the stall and she turned to leave, she found he had taken her whole raincoat in his mouth and was chewing it, the one she was wearing. That's a weird moment. Why do we need to be told the one she was wearing, you know? She twisted around with difficulty and pried it out of his mouth. He eyed her ironically. Just between us, is this the sort of horse act I really ought to discipline? She asked him, smoothing out her coat. I simply incline to your company, he replied. And I thought, oh no, are we going to get a lot of horses talking horses all the way through the book? But we don't really. There's not a lot of kind of projection onto the horse, but the horses actually seem like real different characters in their own.
Well,
right? So I did
really
like that
curious.
Part.
Like again, like not to keep bringing up your horse knowledge, but like you know, the one thing about the book that did strike me was like you know, people who spend lots of time with horses. I mean, there is this kind of you know, they do have this kind of an intense characterization, at least in the book. You know, that they can. You know, project a lot. And particularly, you know, your friend Medicine Ed seems to be able to read a lot into horses. And,
yeah.
And, you know,
I thought that was a really strong part of the book. Like, to me, the strongest part of the book, the thing that Gordon really writes well about is the kind of animal instinct. Like, the way, like, and this is, I think, connected to the erotic strain in the book, that she's trying to write about bodies and consciousness that's not on like a super rational level. Would you guys agree that there's this kind of like fascination with connection that isn't through language, that seems to run through?
Well, that's certainly clear. And like, you know, there's many scenes of like the kind of intense horse massage. I mean, I didn't know.
Yes.
Horse massage is just like, wow, you know, that's, we forget Rolfing or whatever, you know, it's just like, it was like way, yeah, these trainers kind of get like way down in there and, you know, feel the muscles and the, and it's very erotic, you know, the way it's talked about and described and, you know, it's definitely news to me, among other.
Actually,
we're not discussing the craziest moment, though, which is when, you know, the horse gets his balls chopped off and, which, you know, I'm a squeamish dude, but I have to say, like, I thought it was extremely well written. Like, I was like, how are you going to handle the you know, this?
And
I don't know if we can find that.
That was a really, I thought it was
no
a really
one's,
good.
Know, eating lunch while they're listening to this.
But that was a passage where I thought, you know, okay, one of the virtues of this book does seem to be the author's kind of close observation of the world, right? And that they, and what feels that Jamie Gordon really knows the world she's writing about. And that can get fetishized. That could be kind of overdone. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was something that most of all worked really well. My hesitations about the book, I think, are lie on the level of this sort of the prose shading toward purple, as Troy was saying, and then some plot issues and other moments. But Troy, what did you?
Well, I suppose we ought to do the listener a favor.
Yes.
The favor of sort of
summarizing,
sketching out what the plot is.
Yeah.
I think the book is kind of loosely plotted. This isn't.
Yeah.
In sort of rhythm and pace, it feels a bit more like a story cycle than like a novel, I think. I think, and I get that sense partly because of the multiple narrators, partly because I suppose we're on a journey. If the book is anyone's journey, it's that of Maggie, but even she's not sort of like fully in focus all the time. She's on stage, you know, maybe
and
a third of the time.
Do you think that has to do with the prose style, that the way that we're in this third person, this close third person, but there's... Did you feel that the style was obscuring the characterization? No.
No. That's a good question. It's certainly obscuring something. It's a good question unless I reject the question.
No, fair enough.
Where are we trying to head here?
We were going to actually tell people the plot.
Okay.
Yes. That was where we're going.
Oh, yeah. So we're at this crappy little racetrack. There are these new people in town. There's Maggie and her sort of boyfriend and employer, Tommy.
Right.
And he's this sort of slickster dressed as a dude. He is coming in with some horses trying to like, get in, get out fast, and make some money. The Fates have other ideas about this, as do sort of the local folk in organized crime. And so there are these sort of scrappy little alliances form, horses race. Races get won and lost. These horses trade hands. These are what we're largely talking about here are claiming races, which I didn't know anything about until reading the epigraph to this book, which explains that, you know, there are these races you can run. You enter your horse, but anyone else who's entered a horse can buy the horse, which is a way of, I suppose, making the races more equitable. Yes?
Yes. It basically prevents owners who have really good horses from racing those horses against the kind of third or fourth tier horses that, you know, and making a quick...
Because if you put your good horse...
Because if you put your good horse in, the way it works is you don't... It's not like you buy it for any price. There's a fixed price. I think the claimer, like, it's like a $2,000 claimer. That's what they're talking about. You buy the horse for $2,000. Everyone's valued at the same amount, I think, is how it works.
So you're like, oh, I want to win this race. You throw
so you wouldn't
horse
take Secretariat and be like... You know, or you wouldn't take like Uncle Mo, this year's great 2-year-old, and be like, I'm going to run him in this claimer and make, you know, a bunch of money. I mean, you wouldn't do it anyway with good horses because they break down. You want the prestige and the purse and the money. But let's say the middle tier horses that are pretty good that would definitely beat out the claimers. You wouldn't want to do that.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Right. So that's what he's strategizing constantly. A lot of the book is about like not wanting the claim, wanting to avoid the horse getting claimed.
Right. And meanwhile, the horse from which the book takes its title, Lord of Misrule, doesn't show up until the sort of the fourth and final section of it. He's mentioned early on he's sort of coming to this. He's a once noble horse. He's, hasn't quite been put out to pasture in Nebraska. He's been laying low, and he's going to sort of run a special race here at Indian Mound Downs because a guy at the racetrack is doing a favor for a loan shark who also, as it happens, is sort of the great uncle of Maggie and is kind of keeping tabs on her and trying to keep an eye out for her. These facts are not related, and I think I think this is also a problem with sort of the way the book is set up, is that this Lord of Misrule doesn't have anything to do with the first 70% of the book, and he's coming in. It's not quite a deus ex machina situation, but it's a bit random. As random as fate itself is, and luck itself, which I guess is fair. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me tell you what I thought, which is that I thought, well, where is this Lord of Misrule? Because he's invoked early on, but he doesn't show up. So I have two questions for you. Rather than tell you what I thought, to what degree, when Lord of Misrule does show up, he's this kind of satanic force, right? He keeps getting described as the devil, and there's all this talk about, you know, and obviously misrule, chaos, things being turned upside down. The Lord of Misrule is, you know, upending social conventions. There's a bunch of description of Maggie as being unruly in a kind of sexual encounter she has with Tommy, and it's one of Tommy's chapters where he's narrated in this second person, the you. And so he's kind of thinking, and he keeps describing her unruliness. So I thought for a long time, okay, Tommy and Maggie have this kind of violent sexual relationship, and it seemed like he was the Lord of Misrule, and the book was going to move to some precipitating encounter between them. Did that encounter come? Did you have that impression? And also, to what degree do you think this is actually supposed to, in some ways, be a book about spirituality? Is this book supposed to be about spirituality and moral order? Or not at all?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a little bit of that there. Because, you know, like the thing about Lord of Misrule is, you know, he's this horse who is kind of, I don't know if that's the right word, sort of hopped up on butte or something. Mm-hmm. You know, there's sort of like this notion that he's like, he doesn't feel any pain. He's kind of a kind of chemically enhanced, you know, but also has this sort of, you know, killer horse instinct that all horses lacked and that not all horses have. And so, I felt that's very much in contrast to kind of what Maggie was kind of doing, right? I mean, she's sort of kind of going the Earth Mother route with the horses, like kind of sleeping in the barns with them and you know, trying to make them winners and kind of to intuit their feelings and emotions. But I think the second part of your question is, yeah, I mean, you know, she is unruly, described as unruly, and she has this relationship with Tommy, but he kind of drops out as a character in this really in a way that is disappointing in the book. You know, they're often described as he thinks of her as her twin. Maybe we can discuss mm-hmm. their relationship a little bit as much as we
I know,
can
I'm
understand
realizing
it.
I cut Troy's summary of the plot off because I got so excited about the Lord of Misrule. there's actually a lot.
I mean, you know, it's like one of these books where there's a lot, everything's kind of echoing throughout and, you know, it's obviously been the text has been deeply massaged and, you know, we can't pin anything down. But anyway, go on. So Tommy and Maggie as twins, their love, their relationship. And
It's this kind of sadomasochistic thing going on, and there are metaphors for fullness and fulfillment. The sort of metaphors in this way of writing about sex that really should not be tried at home. unless you're Mary Gateskill, I think it's kind of there's some real contenders for the bad sex in literature award in here. Shall I try to find one?
Oh, yes, I think I have a passage here.
But he ran his fingers up inside her, milked the shameless wetness of her.
Oh, yeah.
That's actually not.
That's
even
one of the
notably.
That's one of the calmer ones.
But why is it important that she be so, you know, Maggie, you know, why do you think the decision was made to portray her that way, this kind of submissive yet willing? I mean, you know, it's sort of...
Well, I mean, I guess the book is, in a sense, a sort of coming-of-age story or the story of her liberation. not that it's 100% coherent as such, but I think the sort of the trend in things is has to do with her sort of coming into her own and being her own woman as opposed to a pawn or a possession.
And I think witnessing real pain, right? That there's this manufactured pain in the relationship with Tommy. And there's a line on page 97 where they're having this. Tommy is thinking about her, and he says, "The little key was pain, which turned the lock of every pleasure." And that kind of idea kept coming up. And again, I kept waiting, because it is a novel, you know, I kept waiting for the themes to get pulled out and connected a bit. And Troy, I think the way in which it really does feel like a story cycle in the end is that never quite happens, you know, not on the level of plot, not on the level of theme. Like, there's a lot of loose ends or things that just don't quite, you know, speaking of a lock image, like, that just don't quite click into place. But I think we're supposed to feel that she's kind of witnessing something, that she's sort of slumming a bit, and then she witnesses some real loss that happens through the form of these horses and what happens to them over the course of a year, and then kind of leaves it all behind. Yeah?
Yeah.
Right? I mean...
Yeah, no, she
gets
away. Yeah,
it's a funny combination of having things that are just incredibly well realized and having things that you're just like, what? Oh. You know? I mean, did you guys have this reaction?
Yeah,
also,
like
I was like, what? Did I miss something here? You know, like Tommy just kind of like disappears. Like all of a sudden he's like sleeping with someone else and like their relationship, they're not having sex. And I'm just like, okay, it feels like you're just cramming this all in, like, you know, on an exam, kind of like getting us up, moving us forward in your plot, but not really persuasively so.
Oh. Yeah, and then, you know, minor spoiler, but yeah, Tommy very much just sort of, you know, this kind of con man, charismatic, you know, woman slayer, you know, this kind of becomes crazy. And I didn't understand, I didn't see that, you know, progression at all. I mean, he sort of, what was it, like the horses started working on him? Or it was the kind of the whole, like, track?
Kind of,
or
yeah.
The, yeah, or dry.
Sure, well, I mean...
He gets paranoid.
There's no one, with the possible exception of Maggie, these characters don't really sort of develop. They just kind of happen along.
Yeah.
And then they may respond to.
Now, here's my question, which sounds simple but might be tricky. Is like, did any of this feel real to you? Like, meaning, like, this is a reality-based novel? Or is it, you know, we're just looking at some nice, awesome wood carving, you know, or like it's like
I believe in the track itself. Like, yeah. I like the good sort of vivid sense of place that I get. And there are these sort of like flashes of imagery or metaphor that make me feel like I have some understanding of a place. The people I don't quite buy. The horses and the dog, I feel okay about.
You can hear the horse's footsteps. You know, I don't think it actually feels very real. But, Michael, I'm not sure it's supposed – you know, to me, I thought – I don't think this book is supposed to. It felt like to me what it wanted to be was this kind of like narcotic dream. I mean, that's the sadomasochism too, right? It's like you're entering this sort of other world. And I think though – and that's fine. You know, that would be fine with me. But – I think the problem has to do with the fragmented characters. I think the fact that we have five characters we're following, and most of them, as Troy was saying, I totally agree. With the exception of Maggie, they're just not developed. They just kind of happen along. And so you sort of move into their minds as if just to be shown that one can. And I guess it does solve some problems for Gordon about, you know, fleshing out the track and kind of giving you perspective that Maggie couldn't have. But because there are so many, that question of reality became more pressing, because we want to know, why are we moving into all of their minds, and why are all their minds kind of like this, kind of sleepy and druggy and shot through with strange moments of intensity. The book that, you know, I was trying to think, what does this remind me of? And I don't know if you guys have you guys ever read Kate Braverman? She's this interesting female novelist who also writes very physically and also kind of erotically about these like women who are obsessed with sort of violent men, or men who have them kind of under their control a little bit. And she wrote a book called Lithium for Medea that is also really problematic, but that I like a lot and share some things in common with this. I think that book is probably ultimately more successful in some ways because it's really just in this woman's mind, right? It's all about her kind of. It's a first-person narrative, and it's what's happening to her as she has this relationship with this guy, Jason, and her father is dying. The problem with that book is it has no plot. So this book has plot that moves you along, but it has this weird, it ends up feeling kind of like a, kind of like marzipan.
Yeah.
You know, like it's too, it gets hokey to move into Medicine Ed's head and have him be thinking, and I don't know, everyone feels sort of drugged and disconnected from event.
Yeah, and then,
but maybe that's how life is. What did you think? What did you think, Michael?
I'm not horsey enough, you know? Like, I just felt like there was like a horse mind thing going on here that like I couldn't, there's a kind of a stream of this book that I couldn't jump into.
Maybe we could frame the question this way. I mean, I'm wondering, I wish, have you just read Jane Smiley's book about horse heaven? Did anyone read that novel? Because I think there's a lot of being in the horses' minds. But what do we think, why do you think this book won the National Book Award? Should we ask that question? While reading it, did you think, I mean, because it's interesting, right? This book beat out Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, Nicole Krause's Great
House. Well, I mean, Franzen wasn't on it.
Right, but no, let's just say, like, but it beat out in the sense of a winner,
you know, a book that's like.
But yes, Franzen was not nominated.
Is it as successful as a fictional, you know, as a sort of most, best example of a work that, you know, fulfills its destiny as a fictional creation, or you know, are we, or to use the Franzen model, does it somehow sort of have to, you know, gesture at larger themes in American culture or world culture that make it a particularly relevant and, you know, a winner this year? I mean, isn't that the distinction here? Is like this, you know, the judges must have felt that this was just kind of a beautiful work of art, and you know, I wasn't getting an overly, at least I didn't pick up a strong sense of, you know, how this kind of, you know, comments on our world today.
No, right. It's not. It's not a social novel. Yeah. It's more of a kind of lyrical novel about this world. So yes, it definitely seems like that.
But what are your guys' takes on why it won?
But what are the virtues of it as the kind of novel it is? Would you recommend this to any of our listeners, or no?
Would I recommend this to any of our listeners? You know, life is short. There are a lot of books to read. And there are a lot of books published by small presses worth reading. Is it possible, if I'm going to project myself into the minds of Samuel Delaney and whoever else was on this jury, is that there is a way in which it's sort of a vote of confidence in the small press and the sort of continued prospects thereof? And that's fine. That's worthy. But yeah.
Yeah. I think that must be what it is. I mean, I think one thing, as I was reading this and comparing it to other novels I did or didn't read this year that were certainly got more attention in the press, right? I thought one thing I liked about this novel, or I could imagine finding very appealing, is that it doesn't, I mean, you touched on this, Michael, but it doesn't explain everything for you. It kind of makes you move into its world. And actually that, you know, there are a lot of novels right now that go into a very explanatory mode. You're not having to do a lot of work on the level of trying to understand the language and kind of adapt to its language. Right? The language is always adapting to us rather than the reader having to adapt to it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, certainly.
So I kind of like that about
this book. You mentioned the Harbach essay, the MFA versus NYC, mm-hmm. and you know, he sort of talks about how he puts forth this idea that the marketplace has, like, you know, worked itself into the kind of subconscious of the fiction writer. You know, you're always, even when you're not, you're always sort of framing your writing for a potential reader, and I guess this book doesn't have that feel at all. You know, I mean, not that it was written entirely for Jamie Gordon, but it feels very much like, you know, I'm going to outline the limits of this world and fill it in for my, my creative impulse.
Right. It does have a real sort of like density to it. Mm-hmm. I think I've been sitting here slagging on this novel, in which there is more than a little bit to appreciate. For every god-awful sentence, there's, you know, one striking, powerful one. Density is the note that I've made here.
Density is good. I mean, I think, you know, what's hard for me to kind of get in there and recommend the novel enthusiastically is I do feel like a novel like this depends to some degree on the characters, right? The language is, so there are some bad sentences, there's a lot of good sentences. It's not the kind of style I prefer. I prefer a slightly sparer, starker style. But I can go there, you know, and there's enough that's going on that's interesting. There's enough of those non-chimey sentences that I really did kind of go into that world. But I just wanted more from the characters. Like, I just wanted to have more of a sense of that I wasn't just sort of stopping a while with them, that I was actually seeing something shift and take place. And that does happen for Maggie. But I guess this is maybe the difficulty of writing. You know, Troy, you kept bringing up the word fate, and that does seem like a really important word here. And certainly the title suggests that too, right? That there's this kind of these forces at work, and it's about the track. I mean, there is something non-narrative about the track, right? It's like there's, you know, horses run. There's a lot of luck. There's a lot of superstition. There's a lot of investment of hope and meaning in something that is fundamentally perhaps completely fungible.
Yeah, maybe that's what you're responding to, this sort of notion that, yeah, because that's definitely throughout the book, you know, the larger things tugging at our destinies and but maybe that, yeah, because I feel like you, maybe that's not satisfying for a reader, you know, mm-hmm. sort of, you know, fate isn't a good main character.
I mean, the other, I think, kind of main characters of the book are the horses, and it struck me that this is, you know, a novel that PETA, you know, might give a stamp of approval to, because in some ways I thought, for all the love of racing and the love of horses, there's a real critique and condemnation of the transactional nature of horse racing and what it really is. Did you guys get that reading it? What did you get? I'm curious, as people who don't, you know, have the sentimental relationship to horse racing that I do.
No? Can I sit here and hum and ha?
Yes. Michael.
No. I don't think there's anything, this doesn't really condemn horse racing.
No.
And
but the great horse that they love dies.
Yeah, but I think the book is also here to say that this is the way of all flesh.
True. True.
I liked how it sort of, as a non-horse person, I guess I just kind of liked, you know, horses are horses, and the way it kind of, you know, made them individuals and kind of, you know, showed how to fine-tune them for a race. And, you know, I've had friends who have become obsessed with horse racing and, you know, become part owners of horses and things. And it was an enthusiasm, more than an enthusiasm, that I never really understood. But now, you know, it's kind of starting to see it. You know, so you have this kind of, you know, have the bloodlines, and you're very curious about, like, what traits emerged in the grandson of speculation, I guess, mm-hmm. is, you know, one of the horses in this book. And so I was starting to get a sense of that, how, you know, yeah, just like by looking at a horse, you know, someone with knowledge, you know, the horse will just kind of tell you a whole story and put some money down, you know.
Yeah. It's true. I thought that was really, and you asked before about the horses, and I said I like that. But it was not just the horses I liked. There's a passage where Maggie is rubbing, again, kind of horse massage, right, rubbing down one of the horses, and she thinks about how she could kind of give herself over to this much time spent doing these kind of meditative, mindless things. And it's a really beautiful passage, and there's a lot of moments like that where someone says, like, I'll rub the horse till you see their, like, dapple shine. And there's a lot of stuff about the physicality of horses. And I think one of the things the book does really well is summon the ways in which having an incredibly focused task gives you a sense of meaning and immersion. And it just conjures that in the way that fiction can, I think, really, really beautifully. One question I think I have to ask is, what about the fact that one of the key horses' name is Little Spinoza? And in other places, Bertrand Russell is referred to one of the horse's grandfathers is speculation. It feels like there's all these little allusions, many of them philosophical ones. And I wondered if you had any thoughts about that or had noticed that.
Yeah, I mean, I was down in the red puddle. I don't know my Spinoza. But
yeah,
Troy helped
I started
out.
to look things up and think on all that for a spell, and then had this instinctive realization that that was not going to pay dividends. So I set that all aside. I want to back up and say, it occurs to me sitting here, I think one thing that the book does do nicely is to kind of conjure up a sort of a mental atmosphere around the track. What you were talking about before is this kind of like druggy sensation. I think also has to do maybe with what if we call this book's genre sort of like magical thinking realism? Because there's a way in which if you're involved in horses and the racetrack, even if you sort of say that you don't believe in luck and do not practice magic as Medicine Ed does, there still, because you're dealing with these like living animals, these living beings, these spirits, that I think a kind of daydreamy, not strictly logical way of looking at the world can sort of creep over things, and that the book gets at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think absolutely.
There's also like when some Medicine Ed, you know, mixes up this special powder for the horses called Goofer, and you know, one of the details in the book is like I'm going to get it a little bit wrong, but it's like sort of your mind has to be in earnest, or you have to be in earnest while you're mixing this up. And you know, when I was reading that sort of struck me as a way to kind of approach the whole novel. It's just like you kind of have to have this sort of open, believable, you know, mind, kind of.
Yeah. It's interested in sort of methods of concentration that aren't strictly intellectual.
In fact, not really intellectual in any way, almost.
Right.
And you're right, Troy, because there's this theme or thread running through the book about science versus kind of hopefulness or, you know, sentimentality, you know, of some people trying to practice science and other people just trying to practice kind of love, almost, you know.
And yeah, and like very, like in your... And your livelihood is on the line too. It's not just idle. I mean, so it's like, you know, people, they place their, you know, the people who work at the track or Maggie, you know, they put bets down on their horses.
And,
you know,
that really comes
and
through.
And you know, that's how they live.
I love this magical thinking realism because I think that is what it is. I kept thinking it's not quite noir. It's not neorealism, but there is, it kind of feels like it wants to have this gritty element, but it's not really gritty. It is, it's kind of magical thinking realism is the.
No, it's not gritty. It is squalid.
Yes, it is squalid. It's got a kind of, I don't know, like a kind of beauty too, right? A kind of, partly because of the style of the writing. There's an incredible physicality, I guess, to everything. Well, I feel that maybe we've said everything we have to say about this book. Is there anything else we would add for our undecided listeners?
I'd like to take this opportunity to kvetch, not for the first time, about books that don't have quotation marks.
I
suppose if you're a British novelist and you're using M dashes to denote dialogue, then that is one thing. But
the dialogue wasn't clear enough, or you just felt like it didn't meld?
Well, it
melded into one.
It's just a pet peeve of mine.
Yeah.
I suppose you can't quite blame a novelist because it requires the reader to just concentrate an extra 1% harder on what's happening. And if you want a sort of a certain kind of attention paid to the page, then I guess that's one way to get it with a little bit of a cheat. Am I being like a grumpy old man about this?
You know, it's interesting. So I actually just read All the Pretty Horses again, and which is funny, actually, when we were talking about the erotic before, Michael, and you were going on about the horse massage, it was reminding me of that scene in Kicking and Screaming, the Noah Baumbach film, where they're having the book club about All the Pretty Horses. And or maybe it's Blood Meridian. I can't remember. It's one Cormac McCarthy novel. I think it's All the Pretty Horses, and one of the characters hasn't read it, and he's reading the back, and he's like, yes, it's the horses and the very erotic. You know? And the guy's like, you didn't read this, did you? Yeah, you know, in that novel, I was totally persuaded by the absence of quotation marks. In this novel, as in several other novels I've read, I sometimes feel like it's like, you know, when you're in college and you wear bell bottoms to signify something, right? You know what I mean? Like it felt, right. It feels like a, it's like a outerwear choice. You know what I mean? That's mean, but it just feels like it's a signifier. I belong to a certain kind of literary club.
Yeah.
And as such, I don't feel strongly about it one way or the other, except that that's what it feels like to me more than anything else.
Period.
Period.
Yeah.
Okay, well, should we end on anything else other than quotation marks. Any other last thoughts? Reservations.
I think we said it.
Okay. It's like there's no, none of us are ardent defenders of this novel, but.
Yeah, it was a ride that the judges sent us on. and I'll remember this book.
Yeah.
Certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad I read it. Yeah. I'm glad I read it. I don't know that it would have been the book I would have chosen for the year, but I'm not sorry to see, you know, a book of with this level of writing and interest in a microcosm, you know, be the word. I mean, I also felt like in a way it was a sort of signal that there was a class element to it that I liked, right? That it's like, we're going to show you a part of America that maybe you don't see all that much. And also, this is very much, I think, a book of place.
It is. I'm interested in that. Well, this is a separate discussion about the sort of the class element.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's possible for a certain kind of reader to fetishize a certain kind of book because it's sort of dirty blue collar.
Well, I do think that's going on.
Ambiance. It's whatevs.
I do think some of that's going on. Well, on that note, maybe we'll just say we're all glad to have read The Lord of Misrule, or just Lord of Misrule, and thank you for joining us today, and we look forward to coming back in a future date. Firstslate.com, I'm Megan O'Rourke.